Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Dren McDonald, a San Francisco Bay Area composer who has been releasing music since the 1990s and whose new album, Vox Terrace, arrives July 31st. The LP updates McDonald's 2023 release, Terrace, meaning with wings, by incorporating vocals into the compositions. He's joined by a wide variety of guest vocalists on this new LP. We discussed that as well as plenty of his history, not only in the world of rock and roll, but as a video game composer and sometime label mogul. That's Dren McDonald on Into Music, coming up now. To kind of set this up for listeners who might not know, this actually has its origins in a previous album, which was instrumental.
So in 23, I released the record just called Terrace, which means with wings. And that was an all instrumental record. And it felt like a big enough undertaking without adding vocals or anything to it, because I was putting layers and layers and layers of guitars over each other. It was just kind of this experiment I was trying, kind of influenced by mandolin orchestras. And also there's a record by Steve Reich, Electric Counterpoint, with Pat Metheny playing all the guitar parts. And those are kind of the things I was thinking about while I was writing this, but I wanted to make a bigger sound and it ended up becoming a really good way to meditate and think about the people who these songs were dedicated to, because all the people, I lost about several people in a short span, about maybe 3 years, who all passed away. And it was, you know, dealing with one person in that amount of time is rough, but these people were all fairly close to me, and it all happened in a short time during the pandemic, or almost, you know, in that area. So it was hard to deal with, and doing something like this, like having a project where I could just sit and focus and zone out and play these guitar parts over and over again and just kind of think about these people, was kind of a way to get through it. So that's where the record started. And then apparently I had more to say and started experimenting with adding vocals.
So that compositional process, the way you're describing it, is this just kind of like with each of these, you're just kind of starting off playing? You're not like coming up with ideas on paper or something like that?
Very, very much so. It's all based in just playing, and just I use the software basically as just a compositional partner, and I'm just playing parts into Logic, and it's all rough at first, you know, and just trying different guitar parts and getting shape of the piece first. But nothing on paper. Yeah, it's all just playing, and then a lot of that is very technique based, because I'll try different guitar techniques on some of these pieces. You know, I just have a much better sense of that hearing it and playing it into the DAW and recording it, and putting it down on paper.
So what was the moment that, you know, you said apparently you weren't done, or the songs weren't done with you, maybe. What was the moment where you said, these have to have lyrics?
So I finished that record in 23 and just kind of let it simmer, all the while just kind of still thinking about the people who I'd written these songs about. And at a certain point, I wanted to just give it a shot. I wanted to take one of the easier songs to add a melody to, because that song Fading does kind of have a melody already in that, played by the guitars in the original version. So I thought, well, I'll try it with that one. That one's kind of tailor-made to try this first. So that was an experiment that we did. We actually recorded that with Sophia James, back in early 24. And that was like the first experiment. And I knew that Sophia has this great way of presenting songs. And I thought if anyone could make it work, Sophia could do it. And so we gave it a shot, and it worked out really well. We had to make some adjustments along the way, but that was all on me, just kind of figuring out how this project was going to go and what I was looking for all the different contributors and guest vocalists.
I found it interesting too, right? That it's all women singing the songs.
Yeah, yeah. Apart from me, I sing a little bit on it. Yeah.
What kind of spurred that decision?
Well, I think it's probably due to that. I think the female voice is my favorite instrument. And I think there's, for me, female voice just has a great way of emoting, I guess is a good word to say, you know, just like, there's a lot of texture and a lot of emotion. And I also felt that in terms of these dense mixes, with lots of guitars happening, a female voice would sit on top of that mix a lot better than a male voice would, because of the range. So, and I, you know, I already knew a lot of these people, and so that made it easier too. At first, it just kind of started working out that way, and then I was like, no, I think female voice is definitely the way to go for this. I hadn't committed to that idea right at the beginning, and as we went, it just kind of seemed obvious that was the way to go.
Yeah, I think it really adds well to this kind of dreamlike quality that's present, you know, throughout.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And we definitely went for that as we were recording. Like every time we'd have a new session, I wanted them to all bring ideas to what they had to these vocal parts, because I just kind of had a very general, here's the notes, but I don't always have a clear idea of presentation or texture or whatever. And so we would often play with a lot of those ideas while we're recording. You can really hear it in some of the performances, like Marika, who is Girl Swallows Nightingale. She was playing around with a lot of these texture ideas and just kept coming up with ideas. I couldn't hit the record button fast enough. And and yeah, that really did add to that dreamlike quality for a lot of these things, that kind of ghostly, yeah, ethereal kind of vibe, I guess. Yeah.
So since these are songs about people that you knew, maybe the vocalists didn't know them?
No, I don't think any of them knew who they were singing about. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, I would tell them about the people before we started, and it kind of give them a little introduction to who these people were and what they meant to me in my life. You know, person that Sophia was singing about was another vocalist who I knew. And, you know, I kind of told her story, and I think Sophia resonated with it quite well, because her mother had passed away early on from a disease as well, and just like this person that I had written about. So I think she really connected with that idea. And so I would do my best to try and give everybody a little bit of a background on these people.
Yeah. Yeah. There's going to be a remix of Resting in the Light to come out.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is about a little bit of a person who was a little bit of a mentor to you, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah, you know, when you look back, well, for me, I look back at my career and I didn't appreciate it at the time, but there are a few people in my career who I can point to and go, you know, if that person hadn't really supported me, I wonder where I'd be now. And one of those people was actually Sophia's grandfather, who was my jazz band high school teacher. and he really believed me. And then Resting of Light, yeah, is about Hardy Fox, who was a member of the Residents. And, you know, when I had this crazy idea in the 90s to make a Residents tribute record, he was the one that got back to me, and he was the one that kind of kept supporting me through it. And, you know, I ended up working with them a lot over the years. And a large part of that was just from this relationship I had with Hardy. You know, like I said, I didn't think about it too much at the time, but looking back, I was like, wow, I wonder where I'd be if Hardy hadn't really embraced me and supported me and just been encouraging. Yeah. So that piece, was about him, and I don't really mention that many aspects of that type of the relationship. I just, a lot of the lyrics are really just kind of vignettes of scenes that I remember with him, and even scenes that I wasn't together with him, because towards the end of his life, he had moved up to a little house by the river, and I never saw him during this point in his life. Like, I only saw him when he lived in the right near San Francisco or in San Francisco, and he had moved. And yeah, there's even lyrics that just kind of mentioned, you know, by the river, I never saw you there. Like, and I kind of wish I had, you know, like I just have this missed time that I didn't have with him. But it kind of addresses how we all just get busy and people fade in and out of our lives, and trying to be more conscious of that now.
The idea of doing a residence tribute album.
Yeah.
So I can only imagine, because, right, because that's a band that there's just so much mystery surrounding it. How do you get past those hurdles to, like, get to the band, to get anybody to talk to you?
Right. Right. Yeah. It was very, slow for a while. And then I don't remember how I got the right email, but somehow I got the right email and got a hold of Hardy, but I didn't know who I was talking to. It was just a representative of the Cryptic Corporation when I first was emailing. And then very slowly there was trust built up, and, you know, they contributed a couple songs to the tribute record, and mostly they were just surprised that anyone wanted to do something like that. So once they kind of got past the idea that someone would want to do it, I think they kind of got on board. Yeah.
That's so interesting. So as you were, you know, kind of growing up and developing as a musician, was kind of avant-garde music sort of like your thing, or were you one of these people who, like, drew from a broad range of music?
Yeah, I think that early on, I think I was definitely influenced and inspired by, well, what we call classic rock, AC/DC, Aerosmith, Zeppelin, stuff like that. Being a guitar player, those things, those influences really important to me. I still listen to that, a lot of that music still. But then I started to, you know, really expand my horizons. I had a guitar teacher who was really, he really introduced me to a lot of different types of music, especially jazz. And the more I learned, the more I wanted to just keep exploring. And then, you know, like I said, I was in jazz band in high school. And then by the time I got to college, then things really broke open and I started really getting into, more experimental things. You know, I think it started with people like Laurie Anderson or The Residents. And then you start discovering Steve Reich, and you discover these other kind of, I won't call them esoteric, but the things that are just different directions. And then, you know, African music, got really into African music and soul and funk and just, you know, all those things really kind of spread out pretty wide by the time I was getting into college and playing in bands on a regular basis. And yeah. So I still think that to this day, one of my superpowers in being a composer who writes for different mediums is that I did have that exposure to all this different music and really dug in deep and just bought music blindly constantly just because I was so curious about it. And I think that still kind of pays off because I have all these references that from all those days, and it still is relevant.
The stuff that you've done as a composer, which includes video games, I think amusement parks, all of that I'm guessing was kind of not something that you thought, yeah, of course I'm going to compose for video games. I'm guessing you probably started a more traditional route, like bands and stuff like that first.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was in a band that did a fair amount of touring. It was called Giant Ant Farm, and we had played around the US, South by Southwest, and toured Europe a few times. We were lucky to do that. And then kind of started my own label. And that was where we did the tribute record for The Residents, through my label, Vaccination Records. And so, yeah, it was more traditional as I kind of started my career out. And then as I was doing that, I had the label going, and I started another weird kind of online record store called Clamazon. And because I had all these friends, I had all these friends who had bands and whatnot, and they had all these releases, but no one could get them because they didn't have distribution. So I just created this online store. I had already created an online store for the residents for RalphAmerica.com. And then I created Clamazon. So I was creating these places for people to buy other weird music. And that was kind of supporting the record label. And so I had been doing that for a while. And then eventually I got to the point where I realized I was thinking a lot more about the business of these businesses and not as much about the music. And it was starting to make me crazy. So I was like, okay, I need to just get back into just making the music now, and started looking for ways to do that. And given that I was in the Bay Area, it was a lot easier to get into writing for games than it was for film or TV. I did do a little bit of that, but most of the work was for games. And I had some friends in the Bay Area who had already had a career going in games. And so just kind of meeting and talking with them and seeing how I could get in to do this. It was a very deliberate choice to work in games.
So is that like,
but yeah, I hadn't thought about it. You know, that was like, I remember having this revelation, like, oh my God, people write music for TV and film and games. Like, people have this job. I had not a clue that was a career path. You know, like I never learned about that. And so I just remember that kind of hitting me in the face going, oh my God, I could actually do that.
What was this like maybe late 90s when you started composing for games?
Oh no, it wasn't until mid 2000, like or first like early aughts, 2008 or so, something like that. Yeah, this was much, much later.
Okay, because that's a whole world. Like one of my favorite record stores here in town, there was a clerk, and every time I went in, she was always playing something interesting, right? And then slowly, you know, I would always ask her, "What is this?" And it was almost always like music from a game. And,
oh, interesting.
You know, and so it occurred to me, like, there's a whole generation of music listeners that's like the radio to them.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's definitely true. I mean, there are so many Spotify lists of just game music, and people are just real big fans of it. And there are tours of game music that just, like this game that came out last year, Expedition 33, Clair Obscura. Some people I know in the music industry refer to it as the Nirvana's Nevermind of games. So it's kind of, if that gives you an idea, it just took off. No one really expected it to. And one of the things that people love about it is the music. And so that has been a touring show of the music from that game. And people are crazy about it. They love it. So yeah, this has been going on for a while. There was like Videos Games Live. They would go out and do a new show every year with different game music. And Pokemon, and there's some Nintendo tours and whatnot. Zelda, I think there's a whole Zelda tour that goes out and does Zelda music. So it's very popular. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I think a lot of folks still think of it as little 8-bit or 16-bit beepy sounds as far as video game music, because I'll still tell people what I do, and they just think about Pac-Man or something. You know, it's really evolved.
Yeah, yeah. Miss Pac-Man is about where I stopped with video games.
That was a hard one.
Yeah. So do you game yourself, or?
You know, the thing about playing, about writing for games is that usually the only games you end up playing are the broken games you're working on yourself. So most of my time is playing the game and seeing where it's at. And it doesn't, right now at least, it doesn't leave a lot of time for playing games. I used to do it a lot more when I didn't have to do as much of that, and I would just kind of deliver files and people would make it work. But now I do a lot more of the implementation side of things and make sure things are working right in the game. But part of my gaming was playing with my kids a lot, and now they're out of the house, and they don't want to play games with me anymore because I'm not as good as they are. So my gaming time has definitely been a lot less than it had been in the past.
So I think this is very cool, because it's one of those reminders, I think, of like the different, no pun intended, streams that are available in different arts, that you can still be creative. You can still be writing music. And you don't have to get into a van and drive to Omaha. Yeah.
Right, right. And I have friends that still do that. And, you know, they still love it. But I definitely decided that tour life wasn't for me. And I think the last tour I did was right before our first kid was born. And after that, I was like, yeah, I think I'm glad I did it. I did a lot of touring, got out of my system. But I think relying on that, especially right now, it's really hard. Just, you know, you used to be able to sell stuff at shows, you know, CDs and shirts, and that's harder now. No one wants to buy CDs too much. And then, you know, all the other things, gas prices and whatever, it just makes it really hard. So, learning about this and kind of diving deep into it, I was very thankful that I spent some time learning about it and seeing how I could get into doing it, because I wouldn't have lasted very long if I had to keep going on the road and doing things that way. Yeah.
So what's your model for releasing this album? This is self-released?
It's on my own label, Appearing Records, but yeah, basically, yeah, self-released. I had talked to some classical labels who do kind of contemporary classical, but their lead time, I had never really talked to these labels before. And then when I was kind of done with the record, I just was like, hey, I have this record. You're interested? Well, we would be in 2 years or 2.5 years, you know. Their lead time is so long. They'd really plan things out. I just didn't want to wait that long. So I just decided to put it out again on my own label. But this one felt important enough that I thought it would be good for another label to put it out. But I didn't want to wait.
Yeah. So. Well, and so with vaccination, I mean, you had some experience with this, and when you formed that label, for instance, what was the thinking there?
Yeah, well, I think that was largely inspired by being here in the Bay Area with a lot of the bands that we were friends with and would play live with. So besides my own band, you know, we had bands like Idiot Flesh, who later became Sleepy Time, Gorilla Museum, and Free Salamander Exhibit. And then they had another band at the time called Charming Hostess. And then there was a band called Rue Baudel and a few other Ninewood, Mumble and Peg, all these other local bands. And it just seemed like we were all releasing records, might as well funnel them through the same channel, because it was all kind of related music, and just give you know, radio and press this easy definition, you know, like, okay, it's all under this label. So it must be this kind of music, which did help at the time. So just kind of having a weird art rock label, you know, helped those bands, I think. A lot of did end up touring in Europe and US, and we did showcases and whatnot around. So it was successful to a certain extent, but then still distribution is always an issue. We did have distribution, but just getting paid without having one big artist on the label was always a challenge, you know. So I'm sure that's still the case these days, dealing with physical distribution.
Yeah, but that's also a time too where it's like the Sleepy Time album, grand opening and closing. I don't know how that record found me, but I figured that I was one of the people that was supposed to find it, you know?
Yeah, it's great.
And I kind of feel that's like what happens a lot of times today as more people are putting their own music out. It's like you're not gonna get the necessarily the Led Zeppelin level of sales, but you are going to get music that connects with the people who need to hear it.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, that's kind of how I recently discovered Angers du Poitouin. I mean, I had never heard of them before, and then I just saw it on YouTube. And I'm like, well, that looks interesting. It looks like something. That looks like a costume from the Residents' Vinyl Spats era. What are they doing, you know? And that's how I discovered them. And same kind of feeling, you know, like, you know, that I was supposed to discover this, you know.
So as this record gets out into the world, obviously there are going to be people who know the instrumental version. Now they're going to get the vocal version, but maybe there will be some audience for this album that was unaware of that. So That's kind of a nice thing, a nice moment, because all of a sudden people can go back and rediscover the previous release.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. And yeah, I didn't do very much promotional work on the instrumental record, and maybe that's why I pursued this. I don't know, but yeah, it'll be really great for people to kind of discover both. But I can see that having the vocal version will definitely connect with more people than the instrumental version, because there's a lot more to focus on and connect with, I think, than just the straight instrumental. So yeah, I hopefully people react to it that way.
You've been listening to a conversation with Dren McDonald. Dren McDonald's new album, Vox Terrace, is out July 31st on Appearing Records. You can find out more about McDonald himself and that record at drenmcdonald.com. You can find out more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torn Anderson.